injured man dies. We possess a moment in which to recollect ourselves. In his death, we gather for a moment the essence of our mortality. And in a manner of speaking, we can look both ways back down the course of our life and forward into our future. As if in his death we are provided a kind of watershed and it's almost that we see time flowing back towards its source as well as forward to its ocean. Jeffers was a little over 75 years old when he died. Not too old, but old enough. His wife had been dead 10 years. He lived alone, wearing out the seasons on that bruise in his heart. And his final poems were great gulps of inner agony that she had preceded him into. Everything he could understand about beatitude. Of all persons in his life, he gave her the paramount place. And in the few prose utterances he ever made, somehow she always figured there as the catalyst to his genius, the thing that crystallized his inner energies and enabled him to lift forward out of the circumstances that had bound him as a youth and become a great artist. But I think there's something more than that. And I was thinking this afternoon, that actually he had been with her many, many years before he found his genius. Why was it, if she were that catalyst, it took so long for it to happen? And it came to me that it was the death of his mother in 1921 that must have been the event that liberated the first great poem, Tamar, because that's when it was written. Now, why is that? I don't think he knew it. But you know, when something like that goes,
there's a great breaking forward from everything that formed us. Suddenly we find ourselves a bell rings and we're delivered. Something from beyond comes in outside our lives, and we've struggled all those years, and somebody like that has clarified it. The tremendous thing emerges, the great archetype bursts forth in its flaming reality, and she stood forth, Tamar, the incestuous one, the symbol of incest. Oh, the human heart is dashed with violent contradiction. Broken on the cross of its own perversity, hungering for resolution, seeking those symbolic overtures which will somehow divest it of its inhibitions and permit it to taste its finality. I discovered the poetry of Robinson Jeffers in 1934. And in that discovery, I found God. I had been an agnostic, but the great Jeffersian rhythm broke into me, and suddenly I knew the divine in nature. I knew that God is, and where I would find him, in my own region in California, not in the literary models of the past, the Lake Country of England, the Mississippi, the Midwest, in the Everglades, where other men have found him, but in the coast. And all the long sun-filled reaches of the Golden State, and that tremendous valley where I was born, the San Joaquin. The great Sierra heaved against the east, and the rhythm of the seasons, but also when I found that man, I found my father. And I came to him as a father, as a son comes to a father, with that love, that unconscious love. But I never did meet him. Because if I were to go to him, I could only go as a disciple. And he despised disciples. In that situation, the greatest act a disciple can do is stay away.
don't stay buried. I mean, as it took somehow the death of that mother to project the son into his potentiality, which is only a theory of mine, but I suspect it's true. So too his own death terminated something for me on a much more conscious level. It took me 5 years to overcome the spell of his poetics upon my own style. And when I finally got free of it back in 1940, say about in there, I tried to forget about him and to go a different way, because the son still has to find himself and be a man. And then when I became a Christian, it was only natural that I should put away that image in another step. But often I used to pick his books up and read them, try to understand something of what motivated him, what his solutions were. In many ways, he wasn't well served by his life. I think if the stipend by which he lived had been terminated at some point, and he had been thrown forward into a more actual engagement with the world as humanity has to live it, I'm sure his writing would have taken a different course. There was something a little artificial about his ability to maintain himself out of contact with humanity in that stone tower. But fate itself has these things in charge. And I dare say that although we lack in him that line of development we would normally like to see in a writer, that for the future, from the point of view of the future, it will be that very monolithic character of his work which will be the enduring thing. In our own time, we like change and lightness, the movement of life. When we look back, we like permanence and stability. And a tremendous work hewed out of granite. To block against time. Like a kind of dolmen or a stone hinge. I think his work will one time seem that way to the future, a kind of almost prehistoric in its psychology. Torturous, barbaric, somber, a sullen spirit groping blindly about it for symbols of reference. Great hot cry of the poem uttered. I know that all that violence could have the First World War broke his back, broke his heart. And of that sensitivity, it's almost as if they don't have to experience the events. The very fact that the events occurred is a thing that crushes them. Like Nijinsky, who went insane when the war broke out. Just by the fact that it broke out, he went insane. And Jeffers never recovered his faith in humanity again. But he didn't go insane. Because he groped his way inward to a transcendental vision of both God and man. I sometimes startle people by calling him the poet of original sin, because he seems so anti-Christian or anti-Judeo-Christian. As if he were repudiating the whole heritage of his Presbyterian father. But yet I don't think anyone in our time has delineated the contours of original sin in humanity and attempted to show that humanity cut off from the innocence of primordial nature. I don't think anyone has done that like Jeffers has. And this is one reason why there's been such a storm of criticism that's blown around him, is because he has focused on that separation as the prime fact of human nature. Almost all his violence as a kind of Old Testament ferocity about it. He's not really a tragic poet at all, in the sense that the Greeks knew it. He's too biblical for that. Tragedy is built out of dashed hopes. But the mystic doesn't have that kind of commitment to the course of human event. His eye is fixed on a transcendental perspective. That he's dead. And somehow things are crystallized in his death. So that everything he stood for falls into shape and perspective with beyond the barrier of time that closed it out. And we learn how we hunger sometimes for the death of great men, that we can be delivered from them. Of our own parents, perhaps, hardly knowing it. Divided in our hearts because that filial love by which we live is contradicted by something restless within us that we won't give place to or acknowledge, but the moment of death comes and then all that breaks open. And you see people in the violence of the passing of culture with its evasion of death, perhaps, but if you've ever heard the Irish Keeners, or the way those Sicilians in bells on the funeral pyres. What am I saying? Am I contradicting myself? I mean that somehow in that passage of that polarity, that by which all our growth has maintained its reference and its separation, but we're not separated because they are there until they go. And then suddenly they go. And we are flung back from the grave, almost startled at our new birth, to discover ourselves, wondering now if we are man. Sometimes the death of a great literary figure has an almost stunning effect on a literary generation. But not Jeffers. But he did on me. Jeffers, and the great salient fact is the death of the mother. I know that because my situation was similar to his own. Both our mothers married men 20 years older. Married father figures, you might say, in jargon of the day. And then with what fascination do they project that? Marvelous maternal erotic esteem upon the first son. When the father, sullen because he feels deprived of something that was once his for a moment and has now been transferred to over against civilization the paternal hostility. I did all that too. But he showed me how. I didn't know how before he showed me, and that delivered me. And all that violence in the poem is a great merity. The chop chop of compacted ferocity. The death, the anguishes, the pains, the rapings, the terrible incestuous complicities. fabrications of the dream and of the poems.
I know all that. There isn't an image he ever wrote that I didn't drink of. My life's like a kind of thirst of inner knowledge. I knew all that as I read. Transcendent cosmic mystery evolving out into its own projective future.
Terrible and beautiful. Lovely and appalling. Bill asked me to write a poem on Jeffers for the poetry festival. And I said, no, I can't do anything like that. There's our friend again. Very urgent from beyond.
Also insistent, impatient, never learn.
So one day I sat down and the great poem began to flow. It came out of me in great compulsive gouts. Possessed by it for days. I could not put it down. For 14 years I had been writing Christian poetry, and never a poem that wasn't oriented to the Christian perspective with the Christian symbols. But this one, not that one. I thought I would give him a Christian death in my poem, but his presence contradicted me. And it's almost as if out of my own deeps he asserted the primacy of the integrity of his own convictions. Let it be that way. And so I'll read it to you now in conclusion. Thanking you now for this opportunity. because it's finer than any poem I ever wrote. These things come out of the deeps, you know, and they're not with us to place one above the other. So, the poet is dead. A memorial for Robinson Jeffers, written for the San Francisco Poetry Festival, 1962. To be read with a full stop between the strophes, as in a dirge. The evening, the dusk stipples with lights. The long shore gathers darkness in on itself and goes cold. From the lap of silence, all the tide crest pivotal immensity lifts into the lap. The great tongue is dried. The teeth that bit to the bitterness are sheathed in truth. For the poet is dead. The pen splintered on the sheer excesses of vision, unfingered falls. The heart-crooked hand, cold as a stone, lets it go down. If you listen, you can hear the field mice kick little spurts in the grasses. You can hear time take back its own. For the poet is dead. On the bed by the window, where dislike and desire killed each other in the crystalline interest, what remains alone lets go of its life. It has found finalness. It has touched what it craved, the passionate darks of deliverance. At sundown, the sea wind, burgeoning, bled the west empty. Now the opulent, treacherous woman called life forsakes her claim. Blonde and a harlot, she once drank joy from his narrow loins. She broke his virtue in her knees. the water-non coves of Point Lobos. The white-faced sea otters fold their paws on their velvet breasts and list waveward. But he healed his pain on the wisdom of stone. He touched roots for his peace. And the old ocean boils its wrack. It steeps its lees. For the poet is dead. The gaunt wolf crawled out to the edge and died snapping. He said he would, the wolf who lost his mate. He said he would carry the wound, the blood wound of life, to the broken edge and die grinning. Over the salt marsh, the killdeer, unrestrainable, cry fear against moonset. And all the hardly suspected latencies of disintegration inch forward, the skin flakes lost. On the death-gripped feet, the toenails glint like eye teeth from the pinched flesh. The caged ribs and the bladed shoulders, ancient slopes of containment, imperceptibly define the shelves of structure, faced like rock ridges boned out of mountains, absently revealed with the going of the snow. In the sleeve of darkness, the gopher tunnels the sod for short grass and pockets his fill. And the great phallus shrinks in the groin. The seed in the scrotum chills. The dawn comes in again, thoughtlessly. The seabirds will mew by the window. For the poet is dead. Beyond the courtyard, the ocean at full tide hunches its bulk. Groping among the outthrusts of granite, it moans and whimpers. In the phosphorescent restlessness, it chunks deceptively, wagging its torn appendages, dipping and rinsing its ripped sea rags, its strip-weeded kelp. The old mother grieves her deathling. She trundles the dark for her lost child. She hunts her son. And on the top of the tower, the hawk will not perch tomorrow.
But in the gorged river mouth, already the steelhead fight for entry. They feel fresh water sting through the sieves of their salt coarsened gills. They shudder and thrust. So the sea brutes and the aged gull asleep on the water, too stiff to feed, spins in a side rip crossing the surf and drags down. This mouth is shut. I say the mouth is clamped cold. I tell you this tongue is dried. But the skull, the perfect sculpture of bone. Around the forehead, the fine hair. Composed to the severest lineaments of thought, is molded on peace. And the strongly wrought features that keep in the soul serenest achievement, the spirit's virtue, set the death mask of all mortality, the impress of that grace. In the shoal champ breakers, one wing of the gull tilts like a fin through the ribbon of spume and knifes under. And all about there, the vastness of night affirms its sovereignty. There's not a cliff of the coastline, not a reef of the waterways. From the sword thrust illusions to the scorpion tail stinger Cape Horn, all that staggering declivity grasped in the visionary mind and established, but is sunken under the dark ordainment, like a sleeper possessed, like a man gone under, like a powerful swimmer plunged in a womb death, washed out to sea and worked back ashore. The gull's eye, skinned to the wave, retained the ocean's imponderable compression and burns yellow. The poet is dead. I tell you the nostrils are narrowed. I say again and again the strong tongue is broken. Quirks in the cypresses, and you hear what he says. He is calling for something. He tucks his head for his mate's immemorial whisper. In her answering voice, he tastes the grace note of his reprieve. There is fog in the canyons. The redwoods will know what it means. The giant sisters gather it into their merciful arms and stroke silence. When you smell pine resin laced in the salt, you know the dawn wind has veered. And on the shelf in the gloom, blended together, the tall books emerge, all of a piece, transparent as membranes. The thin leaves of paper hug their dark thoughts. They know what he said. The sea, reaching for life, spits up the gall. He falls spread eagle, the street wings swept on the sand. When the blind head snaps, the beak cranks at the sky. Now the night closes. All the dark's negatory decentralization quivers toward dawn. He has gone into death like a stone thrown in the sea. And in far places, the morning shrills its episodes of triviality and vice. One man's passing. Could the ears that hardly listened in life care much less now? I told you, the voiceless throat, cool silence, and the sea granite eyes, washed in the sibilant waters, the stretched lips kiss peace. Poet is dead. Nor will ever again hear the sea lions grunt in the kelp at Point Lobos. Nor look to the south when the grunion run the Pacific and the plunging sheer waters, insatiable, stunned themselves in the sea.